And we're back. Thanks for staying tuned to WVFF 97.7 FM, and now more true crime in the Lowcountry.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's kind of...
Well, that's understandable.
Jim, I've got more of this. 6:30 says, I didn't mean that. She actually files an affidavit right after she testified before Toll saying, I'd like a do-over. I didn't understand the question. I didn't mean that. And I meant something else. And even to extent, and I love Myra, but she's saying the same thing. I answered a question before Newman that I didn't really mean because the question was confusing. And so I'm saying, how many times are we going to cut them some slack, which is what you're asking us to do? And I'm kind of not interested in that. I'm sort of saying, look,
say
what you mean, and not this crap. I'm sick of this.
She's there by herself in front of a judge, in front of prosecution and defense. She wasn't allowed to have counsel there with her either.
There's no indication she'd ask for it either. On page 58, she makes a comment. Matt Harris asks her about it. And in the interview with Impact of Influence, she says, I didn't say that. And so I'm thinking, here's an example.
Are you talking about when Judge Newman asked her, did you ever see Becky talk to anybody else?
No. That is when Judge Newman, no, that's a separate thing. On page 58, is when she says, they're talking about that Becky has said to her that Alec Murray, let me read this to you. She says, I told her I was unaware that the restraining orders expired and that I was scared. She, this means Becky, said, the orders expired, she, meaning Becky, says, the Murdochs probably got to him. I, meaning Becky, I said, why would they do that? He, Murdoch, harassed me for years. Is basically what Becky replied. So Matt Harris, in the Impact of Influence, asks her if Becky has said that Murdoch, because that is an explosive allegation that we've never heard before, and not in any of the paperwork, any of the pretrial, anything, not in the hearing before Toll, not in anything Dick Harkin filed, that he, Alec Murdoch, had harassed Becky for years. Okay, so Matt Harris rightly says to Myra, did you say that? Or tell me about that. And she says, I didn't say that. Becky, I don't remember Becky saying that to me. Well, it's in the book. It's on page 58.
Yeah.
So I think it's a case, again, I don't know, you know, I'm sure that Myra has an explanation. But the thing is, you don't get that many do-overs in life. So be careful about how you answer questions. Be careful that you understand the question. What's the first thing any attorney does to prep a witness for trial? They say to the witness, listen to the question, count to 10 before you answer. Answer only the question. Make sure you understand the question. Don't answer the question if you don't understand the question. And what I see is not Myra, not just Myra, but Myra, to be fair, Myra, and juror 631 and those two tenants are signing their names to affidavits. That's testimony, by the way, that they're later going to say, well, we didn't know, we didn't read, we were stressed, we were whatever. Life doesn't give you that many do-overs at all. And in a legal setting, what you say has consequences. And how do you guys not know that? It's like, how did the rest of the jurors not understand that when the judge orders them every single day, says, do not discuss this case with anyone, and they go out and take a smoke and start talking about the case, that there's going to be consequences for that down the road, even if it's just that they are denying Alec Murdoch a fair trial. So I see this as an epic failure of everyone.
All right. Question. You ready for a question?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes.
So, Becky Hill and Alec Murdoch had a contentious relationship before she served as the clerk of court at his trial?
I don't know that.
Well, you said that she harassed him, that he harassed
her. No, I said that
he harassed her.
In the book it says that Myra said that. So there's two reasons.
Oh, that
book could be wrong.
That Myra said.
There in the book.
That Myra said what?
That Becky said that Alec had harassed her for years. The context is this.
Okay.
That Becky has said to Myra that Alec must have gotten to Myra's husband. Because Myra is saying to Becky, why would my ex-husband, who I haven't spoken to in years, make that Facebook post and all of that? Okay. Becky is lying. There was no Facebook post. It's a total lie, which is why Becky really needs to be held accountable.
All right. Now, is the name Myra Crosby, is Crosby her married name that she carried, or is that her maiden name?
I think it's her current married name, isn't it, Jim?
Current married name.
Yeah. Is she married Catherine Crosby?
Is she remarried?
She was married during the trial. She was married Catherine Crosby. The summons for jury duty was addressed to Myra Stone, which had been a name in a from a previous marriage, but
yeah,
it was
here's a coincidence. Both of her her current husband and her ex-husband are both named Tim, and I think believe or referred to as Timmy.
All right. Now she is currently a Crosby by marriage?
Yes.
All right. And her previous...
By the way, her
previous
husband is a great dude.
Her previous married name... Her previous married name was Stone?
Stone.
Okay.
Yes.
And her husband is whom?
Both husbands were Tim Stone. Tim Crosby.
Okay. All right. I'm good. I'm good.
Wait a minute, Frank. There's a Crosby that works for PMPED. Are they related?
Oh my God!
Wait a minute, Jim. Because she said that she went home after she was excused, talked to a friend, but knew an attorney.
Well, I got to say this. There's two things that if you throw a dead cat in Collin County, there's two things that you can't hit. You can't miss. You can't miss, if you threw a dead cat, you can't miss hitting a church. And if you threw a dead cat, you couldn't miss hitting a Crosby. All right?
Yeah.
Well, there are an incredibly, incredible amount of Crosbys in Collin County. And I don't know who's related to who. And I asked you that question because I don't know if perhaps I know her husband or I know of her husband. All right, but
well, I take heart to that. I like that because I find her very believable, and I think there's all kinds of reasons for that discrepancy on page 58, including that it was just simply a mistake. But I don't think it might not have been her mistake. So anyway, but she's very believable. But I love the idea that she is actually supported by an extended family there because she's been absolutely vilified and made vulnerable by this doxing. You know, how many times is bad behavior going to get back to the source, which is this Cup of Justice group? And it's
wrong.
You
know, here's the thing. You know, people are attacking her right now who have not read the book. In fact, the day it was, before it was even launched to the public, you know, the book is awful. The book is not credible. The book is all this. The book is all that without ever reading the book. So right away, whoever is saying those type of words, they are not credible.
What forum? What platform is she getting attacked on?
Mostly on Cup of Justice, and what gets leaked from Cup of Justice to X.
Yeah, pick one. But you know, all she's trying to do is say the truth, her opinions of what happened to her, and you know, she's being attacked for that, for putting words into a book. I'm being attacked for that, for putting words into a book. Apparently, these words. Are words that people don't want coming back at them. But, you know, listen, don't do bad things. I won't come back to you is what they had put in this book, because there is a lot of it in this book. Like, let's go for chapter 6, by the way, page 34, for those of you following.
I'm turning to it as fast as I can, okay.
And this is an important one as a juror, right? It's the witness, state timeline, and cell phone data. Now, the state really talked about cell phone data, and you remember Creighton Waters in opening statements, he took his cell phone out and was waving it around and was telling everybody that this is going to be very important information. This is going to basically tell everybody what Alec did, where he did it, when he did it, how many steps he took, all these certain things. But as a juror, her sitting there listening to this, and I'm going to paraphrase a couple of pages of this, this particular chapter, which was presented by Agent Radulski from SLED, was that she really didn't buy into the state timeline and the cell phone data. And according to her, I don't know if it's in the book, but I know that in smoke breaks, she would sit and listen to them talk about this. And then no one in the jury believed that Alec, in the time, amount of time that they're giving him with no blood on him, no blood on the golf cart, no blood in his car, no gunshot residue on him of any substance, all these things, and the amount of time that they gave him to do this was just incredible to her. Not believable.
And by that you mean unbelievable. By the way, that's something getting lost in the book, but she kind of lays out pretty clearly why she didn't think the state had proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. She did not believe they had proved him guilty. And she's not committed, she says in the book, she's not committed to whether he's innocent or guilty, but she does believe that he did not get a fair trial. And I agree with her.
So here's a great little quick couple of sentences I'll read right here from the book. She says, at 9:02:18, Creighton Waters cross-examination describes Alec's phone of taking a lot of steps. Do you remember that? It's a lot of steps. All of a sudden, his phone woke up. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, his phone woke up. It was alive. He started taking more steps and faster than he did all day long. That was huge. But she goes on to say, but if that's true, how does the prosecution explain the slow steps between 8:53:15 and 8:55:32? Because if Alec Murdoch is the only person on the property besides two deceased members of his family, then he has to be the one walking with her phone. And that was just a mere 7 minutes prior, correct? Yes, it was. And in that time, she writes, no one was in a hurry just 7 minutes prior to when his phone supposedly woke up and he was walking like crazy. So she says, who took those steps? She says, Alex. And if so, then Creighton Waters' argument of Alex being in a hurry after he killed his wife and his son didn't hold any weight with her. In fact, she says zero with an exclamation point.
Yeah, yeah. She talks about something else about how they established the time of death was by taking the armpit temperature of the corpse.
I love her comment on that. She's like, would somebody,
yes,
would somebody in Colleton County please go give the coroner a thermometer temperature? Thermometer.
I
don't they, and isn't the accepted method liver temperature?
Yeah, I thought so.
Well, this was at the scene, but
well, they
no,
do.
The scene, there's a probe. You do it.
I see. I see Ducky on what do you call it on NCIS take liver temperatures at the scene all the time.
Yeah. Plus, you know, they talked about. She talks about. Go ahead and Google body temperature of deceased people, even with a slight rain that night at Moselle, and at night, the body temperatures weren't. What am I trying to say, Elaine? Body temperature, I don't think, dropped as fast as she had thought.
No, in fact, I remember doing coverage of this, that they were pathologists. See, the problem with the coroner is they're not a pathologist. People think those two things are the same. Ducky is a pathologist on NCIS. This coroner could be a grocery store manager. They're not the same. They're not medical. Coroners don't have medical training necessarily, whatever. But I talked to two pathologists at the time. They were saying that based on what we knew within the months after the murders, that they would not know. There would be a 2-hour range at best because the rain would impact the cooling of the bodies, and that there were too many variables for these bodies exposed in the rain to determine within minutes or whatever the time of death. So what Creighton did is exactly, there would be, there's too many variables. But what Creighton Waters eventually did was determine time of death because the cell phones became inactive. So they said that must be when they died. So I guess anytime you go inactive on your cell phone, and I do from time to time just because I'm busy reading, I can't take a call, I'm doing whatever it is I'm doing, then you should rightly assume I'm dead. I mean, I'd like a second chance at the prosecution's case. I'm not trying to besmirch anybody, but I think that hopefully the world has said, gee, we got whipped into one of those feeding frenzies we get whipped into because we're so gullible. And maybe they'll take a second look at just the credibility of the evidence. And sometimes when you hear it the second time, you say, hey, now that you mention it, that's not believable. She found Worley, she found Melinda Worley believable. I found Melinda Worley very credible. And Worley said that she couldn't just, you know, that you couldn't Exclude possibility there were two shooters. And I think not only that's kind of as strong a statement as she's going to make, but it certainly was reasonable doubt right there. Just let's say, you know, you can almost say, Your Honor, we move for a directed verdict or whatever. This is reasonable doubt. This is their witness saying there's reasonable doubt. So
I also thought was interesting about her, just to, I'm jumping around the book a little bit now on page 96 and 97.
I'm right with you.
The blue tarp and the raincoat, she thought was complete garbage.
Yes.
Garbage, because she thought, why are they showing us evidence? And she puts that, I think, in quote somewhere, where it was 3 months after the murders that they go and find this alleged blue raincoat. And she talks about the difference, and Miss Shelley, she talks about the difference between a raincoat and a tarp. And I thought it was interesting. She says, Alex arrived at pre-dawn hours carrying a large tarp, which he placed in his mother's house, not a rain jacket, but a tarp. And she says, anyone who lives in Walterboro, South Carolina, knows the difference between a rain jacket, she says, which no one has here, and a tarp. She goes, because we all put tarps over our wood piles to keep them dry, and we know what a tarp is, and so did Miss Shelley.
But one thing, you know, you and I, we did this, we talked about this in True Crime in the Lowcountry podcast much earlier on, so Alec Murdoch is 6'4", and he weighs between 280 and 300 pounds. That's exactly.
Oh, no, he was 300 plus.
I'm talking about what Myra says, not what you're saying. So my husband was 6'4", and weighed between 280 and 300 pounds much of the time. So I know what that weight is. I know what that size is. And Arthur had bad knees. There is no way he could have done what Creighton Waters is saying. He just simply, if you could bend down, it would take him minutes to stand up again. He could not bounce down and bounce up and run over and kill Maggie. But Myra says other things, like if you'd fired that shotgun, you probably, the recoil from the gun, if you're a small person, a person of short stature, you probably ended up on your butt. And that's why the second shot was from such a low angle. And
right, because it was, in that small feed room, which was an enclosed space. So the blast from that would go in and out, almost like a warm air coming right at you. And that, in the recoil of the gun, maybe you're on your heels, maybe you're scared, who knows what, but, falling down is not unheard of at all.
And then she went right at Blanca. She didn't find Blanca any more credible than you and I did. Although, we had to redo that show we did, and I'm not sure if we ever got back to what we didn't. I think Blanca was coached, and I think Blanca is kind of like Steven Peterson. They're never going to say a negative word about law enforcement. Blanca went from high school to the military to working for law enforcement. She respects, she reveres law enforcement. I thought she was coached. And I don't think that Maggie considers her her equal or her close confidant at all. And neither does Myra. And Myra says, among other things, that there's a relationship between those you hire, you're cordial to them, but they're not family members, and they kind of know their place. Like, what was her name, Musha, we were just talking about? She didn't know the family, and so she's talking about observing Alec doing this or that.
She had never even been upstairs in the house in 20 years.
Never even been on the second floor of the home. Would not be help that is sitting there scrutinizing their employers wouldn't last long. She survives because she minds her own business. So these comments she made about Alec's demeanor and stuff, I thought that Michelle was incredibly not credible, not because she's intentionally a liar, but she's so terrified to say anything, especially, and this is going to sound racist, but I think it's true, especially to white people in positions of power questioning her, that she will agree with whatever they say. I thought she was coached. I thought she was terrified. I thought she was the worst, least credible witness.
All right. I have to really express some outrage here on the behalf of myself and every listener. You continually say, Elaine, that these witnesses were coached. I think that we all accept, I accept, and every listener accepts that a witness is coached before they're put on that stand. That is part of the process. And that's not the exception, that's the rule.
Right, okay.
Now,
hold on.
The difference is the coaching alters the testimony.
I will agree with that. I will agree with that. However, the prosecution then should not stand up and go to those defense witnesses and say the same thing as if it was some awful thing that they're doing, and they did that. So listen, it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So don't try to go out in open court and try to.
No, both sides are constantly coached. Yeah, what do you call it? Sure.
No, but listen, you can't suborn perjury. You can't. So
I
would interview our witnesses. So when I worked for Gladstone, I interviewed our witnesses. We can't put on a witness that we know is going to perjure themselves, and we had witnesses that were about to do that. And we can't. There are things you can say. Like I said, you can talk about, listen to the question, but you have to be telling the witness to be honest. But we don't coach them to the extent ever that when they ask this question, you answer this. And that's what I saw from some of these witnesses. That definitely with Blanca. I'm going to ask you this question, and you're going to answer it this way. Because there's a point where she forgets the right answer, and then suddenly it's like she's just, you know, the person examining her sort of just stares at her, and she finally kind of jumps and says, oh, that's right, the answer is da-da-da. And it had to do with where when she was looking for these medical cards for Alec after he had that fake suicide attempt.
That was State Attorney John Meters. And what's interesting about that, from a juror standpoint, Myra states, and she goes, no matter how many times State Attorney Meters would put on his Southern charm and say, oh, I'm sorry, Judge, or whatever fumbling act he was playing with, or his glasses, she goes, it didn't make Blanca seem any more credible to me. This is what I thought was very interesting. She goes, in fact, when Meters' antics got more grandiose, the more I felt I was being given BS. And she goes, in my opinion, Blanca was covering up some other possible misdeeds, and I thought she could have had some involvement in Alex's other misdeeds. So what's interesting is that she didn't think Blanca was credible based off of how the prosecution was acting. Because you're right, John Meters would go, and I'm making this up, so John Meters would go something along the lines of, you know, she would answer a question. She goes, 7 p.m. And he goes, did you just say 7 p.m.?
And she goes,
oh, no, I'm
at 8. He goes, oh, yeah. Right, yeah, exactly. The other one was, and we talked about this, where she says she did something to adjust the collar of his shirt. So one thing I didn't take into account when we talked about it before is that she's not a person of great stature. I'm not sure how tall she is, but I know what it is. I'm 5'4". So if I were to adjust Arthur's collar, I'm reaching up a bit. You know, so I know that very well. So if I'm any shorter than 5'4", I'm going to have to stand on my tiptoes. I mean, I'd have to be wearing high heels to just be up that high. But I said at the time, we talked about this weeks ago, I said that's too personal a gesture. It is, she's invading his personal space. It is, body language experts will tell you this, that is too personal. I don't believe that Alec Murdoch would have allowed that. I don't believe he would want that kind of relationship. He may want extramarital relationships, but not with the help. I just don't believe that.
I think, I don't know. I can't agree. I can't agree.
Because you're thinking immediately of Arnold Schwarzenegger and the help.
No, right? No. Not in the affair kind of thing. That I think that the, that a subordinate employee in the capacity that she performed there, where she cooked and she did this and she did that, and she folded his laundry and put it in the closet and stuff like that. I think it would only be natural and within the purview of her capacity as a subordinate employee to adjust his collar.
See, I disagree. I think she might have said, hey, fix your collar. Or look in the mirror, check the
mirror.
But I wouldn't touch him. It's intimate. It's an intimate. I wouldn't readjust his crotch. I wouldn't put my hand.
No. We're not saying. Go ahead.
Let me tell you what's in the book, because we all have our opinions. And my opinion is coming from the north. Yours might be from the north, wherever you're from. But she's from the south. She lives there. And she says that, and no woman, let alone an employee who is extremely short, would ever in her right mind just go up to her employer's husband and start adjusting his clothes. It just doesn't happen in the South. Now, that is her opinion. We've expressed ours, but that's her opinion. Sitting on the jury, listening to her talk, because you know, as a juror, you're taking your own life experiences, right? You're
well, you know, I wonder this. I'm a woman, and I agree with her. And you, I wonder if it's just a gender-related thing, that you guys view it one way and we view it another. But I definitely view it, it's predatory. It's inappropriate.
I can tell you, I've never had an employee of mine ever walk up and just grab my shirt and just start doing something to it, ever. Never.
Well, Frank must live on the edge, the cutting edge of, well, I don't know. I suppose if you lined up 10 people and said, what do you think? They'd have 10 different answers or something. I don't know. But I wonder
We don't have a lot of time left. But the other thing I thought was interesting, she says, with the Vinnie Vines, remember the Vinnie Vines shirt? She kept talking about Vinnie Vines. she goes out for a smoke break, and she goes, all I remember was him wearing a blue shirt that day. And she said, what's funny was listening to the other jurors talk about what the hell a Vinnie Vines shirt was in the first place.
Right.
They didn't even know.
All right, for the record, we're countdown to 5 minutes. So anything.
So, but again, the jurors are out there talking about testimony, the very thing that they're going to be told not to do.
Right.
I just want to see Alec get a second trial.
I want to see him get a fair trial. I want to see him get a fair trial this time.
Yes. And a trial where, just for the fun of it, just for the novelty of it, we all mean what we say what we mean, and we follow the law. Hey, there's an idea. Because I think that's what we're not doing. And this thing was a circus from the word go. It just was. And
circus.
All right.
Circus.
You handsome devils, where do we want to go from here next week?
Well, this
we
is
want to get Joe McCullough to come and explain. Yeah. What the,
No. I think I really want to explore Jim's book a little more. If you're up with that, Jim?
Yeah, we've only just scratched the surface, and we didn't even talk about the jury tampering.
All right, I mean, and let's try and focus on that. You know, I try and keep you guys in line when you're going off on a tangent. But
now, how does that feel? Does it seem like it's
working? Oh, it's a chore. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm taking a nap.
Just don't ask Elaine what time is. She'll tell you the history of the watch.
yeah. No, we got.
Jim.
I'm kidding. I love you.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not disputing it. Notice how I just said your name a couple times, but I'm not arguing with you. So, you know, if the shoe fits, wear it. That might be true. I'm not going to deny it. On the other hand, I wouldn't be doing radio if I wouldn't be doing content that relies upon having an opinion if I didn't have an opinion.
Yeah, but listen, I got to.
Especially the evidentiary hearing process, and I know Elaine loves the process and the court process. What I think Myra does fantastically in his book, and I laid it out for, is putting out the testimony, the actual testimony. So if there was, you know, words spelled wrong or whatever, that's their, you know, the way they wrote it into a affidavit or whatever it was. So it was written that way. And then she comes in, Myra, and says what her response is, piece by piece, in the evidentiary hearing, which I thought was just fantastic on her part.
It certainly makes clear how juries think. And anybody that suggests that Myra isn't bright or that Myra is motivated by anything other than what she says, no.
Or she's acting because she's out to make money.
No.
She's still published this thing. She's not out to make money. She's out to get
money. No, and she's credible, and why shouldn't she make money? I have no problem with her making money at all. But she's defending herself, and I think that's an excellent thing to do. I'm just discouraged that she has to go to these lengths, that she even has to defend herself. Because one of the things she said, I think, to Seton Tucker is, it's probably in the book, I remember from Seton's, they sort of ended the audio with it, that she would never do this again. She would never serve on a jury again.
She said if she ever saw another jury summons come to her house, she would throw it in the trash. Well, not even open it.
And then she also says that she saw things, some of the evidence, especially of Paul and Maggie's bodies, that she wishes she could unsee, or that they won't.
Well, that's a reality. I mean, you know, that's ugly stuff. Guys, think about what we want to talk about next week.
That was a quick hour.
We're going to set something up, and let's stick to Jim's book next week.
All right.
And Jimmy, good luck with your book sales.
Yeah.
We want to go.
Congratulations, actually, and yeah. Congratulations to Myra too.
Yeah. An incredible, not so much. And Jim, I'm not taking away from you, but not so much you. But I applaud her courage in doing this book. I mean, you're a journalist, and I understand. I mean, you know, you're bred with a tough skin, and you know what you're doing. But here's a woman that never signed on for this kind of notoriety, and you know, she's really courageous about it. And I'd like to, you know, there's a couple of different venues I'd like to get her into, and I still got the opening on two of them, and I'd like to do it. I'd hope you would intermediate in that. But folks, I thank you too much. I really do. And
yeah,
I mean, you know,
absolutely.
you're both an incredible wealth of knowledge. So we're gonna say goodbye. And this is Frank on Target, and with Elaine Greenwood of Super Woke News and Jim Kask of Crime and Kask. And this is WVFF 97.7 FM, Red Brick Radio. And we're out of here, guys. Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for now on True Crime in the Low Country. We hope you've enjoyed our in-depth coverage of the Murdaugh murder trial so far. Don't worry. We'll be back soon to dive even deeper into the case and bring you more chilling stories from the Lowcountry region. We thank you for listening to Veterans for Freedom Radio, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation.